Welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast, where in every episode we explore what is research culture and what should it be. You'll hear thoughts and opinions from a range of contributors to help you change research culture into what you want it to be.
Hi, it's Emma, and for those of you who've listened to my podcast episodes before, I have a new job title. I'm now the Associate Director for Researcher Development and Research Culture at the University of Leeds, and as we go through this podcast, that will start to make a bit more sense. So I've been involved in the research culture work at Leeds for quite a while, and in that role, I've been fortunate enough to work with our Dean for Research Culture, Professor Kat Davis. For regular listeners of my episodes, you will have heard me reference Kat on more than one occasion, either supporting my ideas or showcasing some of her own achievements. And it's with a touch of sadness that I'm doing this episode to celebrate everything Kat has achieved in her role as she prepares to step out today. So in this episode, I'm taking Kat on that dreaded word, journey, covering the start, the middle and the closing of her role as Dean. And I've deliberately not used the word end because I'm certain this is not the end of Kat being a champion for research culture. So welcome, Kat. Do you want to do a quick hello before we jump into the questions?
Hello. Just reach my tissues before we start. So, really good to be back here. It really feels like completing the circle. I think we did a podcast about 4 years ago, nearly, as I came into the role. So it's brilliant to have this opportunity to reflect, particularly with you, have this conversation about, you know, where we've been over the past 4 years with all the people that we've worked with at Leeds and beyond while I've been in the role of as Dean.
Brilliant. So we'll get stuck in. As I said, I've pitched this as the beginning, the middle and the closing. So let's start right at the beginning. Your role was a first at Leeds and it was actually one of the first across the sector. There wasn't anyone to hand over to you and there were very few people who were attempting similar things. So I wanted to reflect on what actually attracted you to the role in the first place.
I can remember it really clearly, you know, when the first papers started coming to some of the faculty research committees, where people were starting to talk about this thing called research culture and, you know, what did it mean? What was it trying to do? And once I'd sort of scratched the surface, I realised it was about really kind of diversifying what we think of as excellent research. It was about creating more sustainable and enjoyable research systems. It was about making our research more open. It was about all sorts of things. And I thought, you know, first of all, this is hugely important. And I remember a colleague on one of those research committees going, "Poor, wouldn't touch that with a barge pole." And I just felt entirely the opposite. I felt like, yeah, this is where I want to be. It's where I want to get stuck in. It's where I can hopefully make a difference. Cliched as that sounds, you know, I had, you know, stuck my hand up a few times where I felt that things could have been done better when I was in sort of more junior roles, and that had, you know, quite sort of local impact. But this role, because it was at the university level, it felt like this is my chance to really do things on a much broader basis within Leeds. And it was the chance to really look at, you know, that very long list of things that, you know, researchers are aware of. So things like authorship, you know, who gets cited on papers, who gets named on papers, how we reward each other, how we decide what is good research, how we employ and hire people, that stuff which is kind of happening around the edges of what we think of as our day jobs in research. But actually, these things are hugely important. They can, you know, they have the potential on the negative side to really derail the progress that we make in research, the rigor that we do research with, people's well-being. So it's really not peripheral. These things are all absolutely at the heart of research. So I wanted to be able to kind of pull in those things which were often kind of sidelined and make the case as to why things are important, and then to set about improving them at Leeds.
Okay, so there you have it. Pretty much everything to help you decide you want to take on quite a challenging role. I'll be honest, I've been through this with you, and it's not always been easy. When you took on the role, you already had some very clear ideas about what you wanted to achieve for yourself, but also for the culture at Leeds, and then across the sector as well. But can you remember what they were?
What I wanted to achieve?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a few things which have stayed constant, and a few things which I've kind of learnt along the way that I've wanted to change or influence. So I think probably since doing my PhD, if not before, I've had some amazing role models, but they've often been sort of in the wings, and have been hugely influential on a kind of personal level and within their research areas, but they've really not been, you know, sort of splashy and high visibility in terms of who gets featured in the university comms or, you know, wins these awards or whatever. And I really wanted to elevate and diversify, you know, those ideas and those role models of what makes a good researcher. So to have some kind of steer on that, I think I really wanted to do. I wanted to actually bring together academics and professional services colleagues in the research endeavour, because I had seen quite a lot of divisions there. And if I'm completely honest, I didn't fully understand or recognise the influence and the role that a lot of our professional services have in enabling and doing research, frankly. And I also wanted to, you know, I've been wearing two hats all along with this, because the role has continued while the role has gone alongside my regular kind of research professorship in language development. And so I've had to juggle those two things, but I wanted to draw from the other side and to use my research training in this new field to really lend that kind of credibility to the research culture endeavour, to produce some, you know, data-driven business cases and evidence as to why this stuff has to change and how it can improve our research culture. So, yeah, I guess in a nutshell then, to diversify our ideas of research excellence, to bring together all the different types of people that enable and research. And I'm going to quote Kay Guccione, who is, well, how can you describe her? A research culture queen. She's been very influential on me. And she said a while ago, she said, we need to make research culture work for everyone, one practical change at a time. And that practicality has been really important to me. Although I've had to be strategic, it's the, you know, concrete, measurable, tenable changes that has been really important to me.
Thank you. So I remember when you came into this role, one of the first things you said to me was, we need a strategy. And quite honestly, I thought, oh no, not another strategy, not another piece of paper that no one's going to read, that we have to report to. But you genuinely believed it was important. And why was that?
So there's two reasons for this. One is a practical reason, and one is a, I suppose, more political reason. So I absolutely empathise, Emma, with the, oh God, not another strategy feeling. It has at times felt like strategies have just been raining down on us, and I know the community have felt like that as well. But I was determined that our strategy was going to be different. It was, again, going to be concrete and practical and actionable. And so that was the spirit that we entered into it with. So the two reasons. The practical reason was really to contain this enormous buffet that we call research culture. You know, it contains so many different things, and I'm not going to list all the different aspects. You know, I learned quite quickly that you people can make a pretty good case that anything is research culture, you know, from catering and car parking and toilets and showers and pay and, you know, everything in between, right? So I needed a bit of a some boundaries, I guess, and the strategy helped us clarify what we, well, what we did was to present four big kind of buckets, I suppose, for what the research culture strategy was going to contain. And that was diversifying research activity, embedding EDI, open research, and researcher development. So those are really big buckets, and they've served us really well because they contain lots of, or they can accommodate lots of different things, but they can also draw a line and allow me and colleagues to say, yes, that's important, but it's not in the strategy. It's not what we're prioritizing right now. So practically the strategy was really helpful for that, for sort of drawing a line as to what in, what was in and not in our purview. The sort of political reason was I felt like we needed that strategy just to be on a level playing field with the many other priorities within the university. I felt like it would help us again gain credibility, to be taken seriously. We have this robust plan with key performance indicators and metrics that would enable us to really show the distance we've travelled. So that was really helpful for senior buy-in, for grassroots buy-in, for really kind of leading honest conversations, getting people in the room. The S-word strategy does kind of focus minds, actually. So, yeah, that was the sort of political reason around credibility, to go with the practical reason of drawing some boundaries.
Brilliant. Thank you. So that's kind of covered off the beginning part of this podcast, and we're now moving into the middle bit. And this is going to feel a little bit like that feedback sandwich. So I've got two nice questions followed by an icky one in the middle. So first nice question, what do you think has been the easiest thing for you during your role?
It's a very nice question, and I think I might respond to it a bit negatively, actually, but I will correct. So it's been very easy to find problems. So, as I said, when the role came up, you know, it was like, roll our sleeves up. There's so much we can get stuck into here. We were not short of problems to address. So, yes, finding areas where people were a little bit wounded by research systems, or they felt excluded, or there'd been some unacceptable, unprofessional behaviours. There were, yeah, so lots of kind of issues. I mean, it's a very sort of issue driven field. This is about reform, right? And why would you reform something that's working well? So it was very easy for me to see issues and problems, and there were quite a few stones that once I looked underneath them, you know, it was quite ugly out there at times. So yeah, finding the problems was not a challenge, but more positively, finding the solutions was also fairly easy, and that is due to the people out there in the university. So not long after I came into role, we were granted, along with all other English universities, granted some funding from Research England, which was dedicated for enhancing research culture. Clues in the name, right? We've got a culture. We need to enhance it and improve it. And we decided to approach that funding with a decent proportion of it for an open call. So people from the university could pitch for amounts of funding to further projects that are meaningful to them in their environment to rectify some issues with research culture. Now, the response to this was amazing. So over the last 4 years, we've supported and processed more than £2.5 million worth of project proposals. And that contains all of the ideas, the energy, the commitment of, I think, close to 500 colleagues across the university of all different disciplines, career stages, roles, etc., like genuinely diverse. So that appetite for culture change was clearly there, And, you know, people were just clamouring to get involved and to use this money to make changes. So that momentum was very easy to start. It was almost kind of self-propelling, right? So that was easy, and really the best way of doing it. There was no point in us kind of telling people what needed to be done. It had to come from the community who were dealing with the issues and had some great ideas.
And I think that's actually it's what's driven us as a team, that we are not here to do it for them. We are here to encourage and enable them to do it. I do remember us having a slightly nervous moment of, are we going to launch this call and is anyone going to apply? And I think in about 24 hours, we knew that, yeah, we were probably onto a bit of a winner with this one.
Yeah, that was not a problem.
No.
Yeah.
So now the icky bit. What do you think has been the biggest challenge that you've had to overcome, if in fact you have actually overcome it?
Yeah, there's a bit of a list here, so I'll have to be selective. I suppose one thing that surprised me as to how hard it's been is defining research culture. So I thought, you know, we will put together a statement, we'll put that out, a definition of research culture, then along with the strategy, you know, it'll be done. People will understand what we mean by research culture, and on we go. But it's really been a continuous process of defining what we mean by research culture, integrating other people's perceptions of what they believe research culture is, because that's quite informative as well when it contrasts with our own. So, yeah, defining and redefining. And, you know, even last week I was having a conversation about what research culture is and isn't. And there is a, I would say, a misperception out there that research culture is like the culture of doing research. So just because an area is producing papers or increasing their numbers of PGRs or increasing their grant capture, there is a perception that this is research culture. Now, all of that is really important, but that is the what of research. And we're all about the how of how that research is done. So it's not just the culture of doing research. It's the culture that research happens in, with everything that entails. So the defining part was surprisingly hard, actually. Also, maybe it's better to say surprisingly longer term than I'd initially imagined. Politically, it's been really interesting 4 years as well. There has been a perception that somehow good research culture compromises research excellence or research quality. And, you know, I've had to go in quite deep to understanding that mindset. And I completely acknowledge that it is possible to create high quality research in negative cultures, like that can and does happen, but is not sustainable. There's a lot of collateral along the way. And so now we're in the business of really gathering our evidence, showing that correlation between good inclusive research cultures and good high quality research. And that evidence base is growing. You know, one example is, if you want to hire the best people, the most inclusive pool is going to help you get there. So, yeah, that's been a challenge, I guess, in pushing back against that narrative that this is either just something additive, something else, something which is kind of a nice to have, or more detrimentally, it's something that compromises research quality. And we know that's not the case. What else has been challenging? I suppose deciding on how to do this, right, has been challenging, because, as you said, this is an inaugural role. We are a fairly young team. So there's many ways we could have approached the research culture endeavour at Leeds. So one kind of dilemma I had was, do we want to raise everybody up to good basic standards of, you know, passable research culture? So get that broad reach. Or do we want to enable pockets of really ambitious, elaborate ideas? And I'm actually still not fixed on that. I have kind of wavered back and to over the years. I think what we have now is a bit of both, that we are, you know, needing to raise everyone up to that kind of hygiene standard, you know, make sure our research is openly available, for example, make sure we're training our postdocs, right? You would expect this to be our basic level standards. But then when there's been funding from elsewhere, so Wellcome, for example, or Research England, that's really kind of allowed these experimental, really ambitious approaches that then roll out, produce toolkits and you know, enable a wider reach of that sort of thing. So that choice between like the wide approach or the pockets of excellence has been difficult, I suppose, at times to decide on or commit to. And then the other decision or dilemma I had was, do we go grassroots here? Do we engage the community first? Do we co-produce this endeavour with the entire university, the research aspects of the university, or do we kind of go more strategically and work with very influential people, so senior leaders? And with that one, I went with the former. We went with the community driven approach, which has been joyous in some senses. It's been difficult in others. There has been perhaps a trade-off with the time I've been able to spend with senior leaders on that. So I don't regret it, but it was a choice. And I know other institutions have done things a little bit differently. I think sometimes you've just got to do it, just, you know, suck it and see. In some ways, one may not be better than another. So, you know, we just had to crack on at some point.
I think that's key, though, isn't it? We didn't know at the time. It was new. It was risky. Personally, I would always go for that grassroots approach because culture is about people. It's not something that I think you can dictate from on high. It has to be led by the people who are living and breathing it. And also understanding that it isn't just one culture we're talking about here. There are multiple different research cultures that make up the environment in which we work.
That's right. And I've noticed that in terms of the language. It's a subtle change, but over the past 12 to 18 months, I'm hearing and reading much more about research cultures, plural, than research culture. And I think that's because of that recognition that there are many different cultures that make up our overarching system.
Certainly doesn't make defining research culture any easier, though.
This is true.
So if I had to push you, what are you most proud of from the last few years leading this research culture work?
Well, there's some things which I'm really proud of, but actually I can't take credit for. They've just sort of happened on my watch. So I put in that category the technician revolution, I would so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen enormous changes in the recognition, empowerment of our technical professionals at Leeds over the last 3 or 4 years. And that's thanks in no small part to brilliant colleagues working on the technician commitment, culminating in, you know, the very recent Technicians Week and all the brilliant kind of showcasing of the work that they do. So that has happened, and I can't take credit for that, but it's been really, really lovely to see that. When things have been hard, I've looked to the technicians and gone, things are okay.
Yeah.
So that's been great, and I wish them every success going forward with that. I suppose within our team, I'm really proud of our range of kind of concrete initiatives, as I started by saying earlier. So we wrote case studies on pre-releasing interview questions. You know, we did that. We piloted it. We gathered data on the reception and the impacts of that. And we've published that externally, and we've had a lot of really nice feedback on that externally. The same with our experiments in partially randomized allocation for grant funding. We did the same kind of process. We tried it, we gathered data, we published it, we shared it, and, you know, consult on that actually quite a lot now. The other piece is the piece on behaviour change. So we worked with an external researcher using behavioural systems mapping to investigate what drives unprofessional behaviour within the sector. And again, that was a really kind of rigorous qualitative approach, which collated a lot of data to really show some of these systemic drivers of the behaviours that we see that really kind of threaten our research progress and well-being. So each of those case studies has been very satisfying, actually. The other thing I want to mention is our Ready Fund, so our research EDI fund that was inspired by colleagues in the EIU, the Equity and Inclusion Unit at Leeds. It's an initiative that uses positive action, so where demographic groups who have been traditionally marginalised in research are given some extra support to achieve equity with their colleagues who actually don't need that extra support. So again, this was a data driven project which showed that the progression of researchers from grades 9 to 10, so the sort of pre-professorial stages amongst researchers who are women, disabled and people of colour, really kind of drops off relative to other demographics. So we were able to allocate some internal funding. We've awarded that to 36 applicants over two rounds within Leeds. So from our surveys, we know that around 40% of researchers in general feel that they have time to dedicate to their professional development. Now, that drops a clear 10% for people with caring responsibilities. And often they are women. More often than not, they are women. So, yeah, we were able to, again, identify that problem, present the data for present the business case to get the clearance and approval to do this, and then, you know, to get to a point where we are awarding that funding, targeting it at the place where it would make the most difference, and now we're looking at the evaluation of that. So yeah, that's also been a really satisfying project.
Brilliant. And Kat's mentioned quite a few things there, so I will make sure that I put all of the links to our case studies, any websites that we've got that talk about the work. The one thing I am particularly proud of is that we do share wherever we can. We are open about what works and what doesn't. So again, I'll make sure it's in the show notes for you. So I said at the beginning of the episode that things have started to change at Leeds. And the one thing I'm really pleased about is that the research culture work will continue. And the team has moved to sit alongside my research and development team, creating what we are calling the super team. But this comes because you've decided that now is the right time for you to step away. So can you explain why it's the right time for you?
Sure. So it's been 4 years, as I said, in role. I think the original agreement was three, but I still had stuff to do at the end of 3 years, so we extended by a year. And it feels like we are sort of coming to the end of Research Culture 1.0. As I said, it's been that period of like raising awareness, getting our heads around what is this thing, what needs to be done, clarifying, prioritizing where we go first. Implementing a few things, as I said, sort of trialing a few things in different areas and starting some early stage evaluation. So that's been amazing. It's been amazing to be part of Research Culture 1.0, but I do feel now it's maturing into something else. More or less every institution, at least that I have contact with, whether that's research intensive or teaching intensives, actually, are all absolutely on it with research culture. It looks quite different in different areas, but lots of institutions have strategies and approaches and action plans. And so it feels like that spread is there now. We are, you know, embedding. And I think now it just needs a fresh approach, a fresh kind of leadership for the next stage where we're enabling people within the university rather than trialing things ourselves. And to be absolutely honest, Emma, I can't resist like doing experiments and and getting a bit too involved, if I'm honest. So I think that's not helpful, actually, at a time where we want to transfer that agency to the community a bit more. So, yeah, I need to be kept away probably from that next phase.
I should also point out to the listeners that Kat was originally doing 3 years and hadn't finished everything at the end of 3 years. I did try to persuade her she hadn't finished everything at the end of 4 years, but nah, she pushed back. She's off. So, yeah. Well, we'll come back to that bit. So taking you right back to the beginning, have you achieved what you hoped you would?
Oh, you know, it's so hard to measure, you know, research culture with these kind of metrics. This is what I've learned, right? We can, so we had, I think, what was our list of like 86 metrics or something we had in our scope workshop. And, you know, culture is how you feel. It's about how you feel at work. It's about whether you recommend the university or the department as a place to work for your colleague or whatever. So it's actually a really hard question to answer whether I've achieved in terms of those kind of KPIs. But thinking, I suppose, in a more holistic way, I think we do have a broader, more diverse idea of excellence. I'm certainly seeing more diversity in the university comms, in the people that are held up as role models. So, yeah, I think we've made some really good progress on that particular aim. I think research is more open, and I think people are, so researchers are better at recognising what they do as open research. So I remember when I started, open research had quite a tight definition, right, of like open access. And I remember having, you know, quite a few almost kind of stand up rows with people, like particularly my own faculty, I will say, in arts and humanities, that, you know, what they're doing isn't open research because that's data and code, and they don't do that. And I'm like, well, look at this amazing participatory filmmaking that you're doing. Look at this co-production that you do. That is open research. So I don't, maybe I retract what I just said, that people's research is more open. I think they're better at recognising that what they've always been doing is open research. So that's another win. I think, you know, the thing with research culture is sometimes you discover so much by accident because it's culture, because it's really hard to pin down. And, you know, I go about my regular kind of professorial duties and I might sit on promotion panels or review a paper or whatever. And I see culture improvements in each of those things. So, for example, in a promotion interview quite recently, someone was talking about a particular model that they use within their lab, a model of management within their lab, where junior staff are given a lot of responsibility for putting forward papers and, you know, well facilitated. So you get that distributed leadership within this particular lab. And that person had been doing it for years, and, you know, we didn't know about it. And so I'm constantly kind of finding out about these great examples of research culture. I think they've probably always been out there, but it's just about kind of surfacing that. And I think having this badge and the strategy of research culture allows people to hang those initiatives onto something and say, yeah, we're doing great research culture. So that's been really nice to see as well.
And that was evident, wasn't it, when we did the Research Culture Awards? Some of the stuff that we were finding out about may never have actually been discovered, because it was just happening and people didn't necessarily realise how unique and novel this was.
Yeah, that's right. It's been really important in joining all of that up. Yeah.
So we're going into the closing, not the end, just the closing. I don't believe for one second, Kat, that you're going to wake up tomorrow morning and forget all about research culture. But you are going to be coming at this from a very different angle. So what comes next for you, and how are you going to continue to be that champion for research culture?
So the honest answer is I don't know precisely what comes next for me. I've got a period of research leave, which I'm really looking forward to reconnecting with my research in early childhood education. But increasingly alongside that, I am attracted to sector-wide, national, global initiatives in research culture. So the UK has a meta-science unit. The Meta-Science Alliance has just been launched. So this is bringing people together that are doing research on research, which is not quite the same, but absolute bedfellows with research culture. And I think there's lots of exciting opportunities there to get involved with the meta science movement. I've been advising Wellcome, the Wellcome Trust, over the last year, and I've been approached by a few other funders to do something similar, to really look at the impact of funders' initiatives in research culture and examine what funders' responsibilities are in improving research culture. So, yeah, I'm quite interested in pursuing those kind of opportunities as well. I'll be involved with REF 2029 as well, I hope. So ensuring that the people, culture and environment element of REF 2029 proceeds in the most effective way, and you know, bringing all of the learning from my term at Leeds into ensuring that that part of the REF is sustainable. It's helping the change rather than, you know, imposing or testing certain metrics that we need to get to. So yeah, basically ensuring that that's done in the right way.
Okay, so we are almost up to time. I want to give you one opportunity before I finish up to bring in anything else you want to cover that I haven't asked you about.
I don't think there's anything else that I want to speak about particularly, but just to kind of pass on to the listeners just how enjoyable and fun this has been. We've spent this conversation talking about, you know, the good, the bad and the ugly, and that is genuinely a part of research culture work. You know, it does take courage for sure, but it's been really satisfying. And it's been a real joy to work with so many different types of people that I probably wouldn't have ordinarily come into contact with as a pure researcher, and to, yeah, just kind of work together in amplifying the work that people do and making good changes.
Okay, so with that, listeners, we are up to time. So I want to say a huge thank you to Kat for all of the work that she's done to support research culture, including providing the startup funding for this podcast. We won't forget that one. I wish you all the very best with what comes next, and I will leave you to have the final word.
Thanks, Emma. It's been a blast.
Thanks for listening to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. Please subscribe so you never miss out on our brand new episodes. And if you're enjoying the discussions, give us some love by dropping a 5-star rating and written review, as it helps other research culturists find us. And please share with a friend and show them how to subscribe. Thanks for listening, and here's to you and your research culture.